listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
We're really lucky to have three incredibly talented filmmakers with us tonight. I consider the program a behind-the-scenes tour, a making-of, if you will, where we get to explore the filmmakers' motivations for sharing Native stories, how they approach filmmaking, and also look at the interconnectedness of these stories and communities. Tonight we'll see excerpts from two incredibly well-crafted, moving films that show the range and depth of documentary filmmaking. Bearing Balance and Resistance brings us into the lives of the Inuit community who live on an island in the Bering Strait through the lens of director Lourdes Grobet. Her visually stunning film depicts a community striving to find balance between tradition and modernity, and her work is marked by her artistic eye, developed over the years as a contemporary photographer. Grobet has exhibited her work all around the world, and we're honored to have her here with us from Mexico. The full documentary screens tomorrow, its U.S. premiere at USC as part of Ambulante California. Also tonight, we learn about the Native activist and national civil rights leader, LaDonna Harris, in Juliana Branham's film, LaDonna Harris, Indian 101, which is the first ever documentary about Harris and her work in social activism that helped reshape Indian country here in America and abroad. The film's impact in telling Harris's life story is far-reaching, from growing up in a Comanche family to her influence and role in strengthening indigenous cultures around the world. The film makes its LA premiere when it also screens tomorrow at USC. I really hope you can see both films. Producer and director Juliana Branham is a Comanche herself and is based in Texas. She has extensive experience in filming Native American stories, from her first film, The Creek Runs Red, to PBS's We Shall Remain. And leading us in conversation tonight is Yolanda Cruz, a filmmaker from Oaxaca, Mexico. Cruz's full-length documentary, 2,501 Migrants, like the films we discussed tonight, explores questions of art, the artist, and the indigenous community. Cruz is an alumna of Sundance Institute Native Lab, and her work has also been screened worldwide. Please join me in welcoming these filmmakers to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. And we have a lot to talk. And I'm fortunate that I was able to watch both of your films, and I really love them. I hope you get a chance to see them tomorrow, but we're going to see a little clip, and that will give us a sense of what a beautiful craft you have made. So we have a lot of questions. I have a lot of questions. But I'm going to start first with a basic one. What brought you to this project? Why this project?
I'll start. I'm Juliana Branham, by the way. LaDonna Harris, Indian 101 is my film. I was doing research for archival film research and photos for PBS's We Shall Remain series for an episode on the American Indian Movement. And when I was ordering in this footage from that era, I started getting in a lot of footage with LaDonna Harris in it. And LaDonna is a relative of mine, although a bit distant. I didn't actually know her growing up because she lived in Washington, D.C., but I knew who she was and I knew that she was important. I didn't know exactly what she and her husband, Fred, he was a U.S. senator, and exactly what they had done. And so I started collecting this footage and watching it and learning more about her and realizing, wow, she's really something, and took you know, the seed was planted then with this amazing footage that I was receiving. She was sort of in the 60s and 70s. She was sort of almost like a pop icon. It was, I think, trendy at that time to be an indigenous person. And so the media loved her, and she was also quite beautiful and very charming. And so I think that just naturally attracted the media. So there was a plethora of footage and photographs of her that I got to mine.
Wow.
So, and learn more about. So I approached her, and she was thrilled, and it was really wonderful, an amazing experience to learn from her. She's the most inspiring woman I've ever met in my life. So
beautiful. Lourdes.
Well, by the way, I'm not a filmmaker, but I have been into image all my life because I study art, and I became a painter, but I found out that we were the first multimedia generation, so I get rid of painting, I burned all what I had paint and draw, and then I started doing photography, but in a very experimental way. I'm not a documentalist, even in still photographs, but I have a lot of work. I mean, I have around 40 years working as a photographer or whatever. I don't know what I am right now. But and in the middle of my career, I thought of working on movement, image in movement, but my autonomy stopped me because with my camera I could do whatever I want. Going into film, that meant that you can lose your life trying to do a project. So I decided to stop that. But when the video cameras were very allowed to everybody, and then the digital stuff make it easier, then I had the chance of going into movement. And I had a lot of experimental work, and my work most known is I stay 30 years documenting wrestlers. And but suddenly, I mean, it's a long time since I started with this Bering Strait project. I went to interview a lady that she is handicapped. And I was working for a handicapped magazine, and when I met that lady, beautiful lady, I don't know how, she had an aura, incredible. And she saw me and she said, "Lourdes Grobet, oh great, I had a dream last night that I crossed Bering Strait and you photographed me. And I don't know what happened to us, but I went back to my house and then I called her up and I said, 'Yolanda, we must cross the Bering Strait.'" And then we started working on that and that idea, and we had a lot of reflection about what the meaning of the Bering Strait was. And then we decided not to take that as a geographic or historical way because that were not our interest. And we were not historians or anthropologists or whatever. So we decided to work on the meanings of what's the meaning of the Bering Strait. And then I'm going to do it quickly, because it's a long, long, long process of studying and reading and everything. So I got the money, because without money you cannot do anything. You can have the best ideas, but if you don't have the way to realize them, you are lost. So I got the money and I went the first time in the way that I like to work, or that way, the way that I have been working all my life. That it was like a performance going, because I wanted to go from Alaska towards Siberia in the other way around. Because I must say something. When she told me about Bering Strait, something remind me, since I was a little girl, I didn't believe in that hypothesis, because this continent, America, is not well studied. So I guess that the function of cultures were in a different way of that. We cannot think that from the Bering Strait came the civilization, and especially being Mexican, because I think that we have a very high, I mean, you know, our civilization mm-hmm. and our cultures are very, very high level. Mm-hmm. But so that I start working on that, no? So I know what I try to do is like concepts, no? That's the way I work. So I cross the Bering Strait in the other way around. And nevertheless, that it was, I went in summertime thinking that it was an easier time to go to the Bering Strait. But it was worse because the currents that came from North Pole, and then it's foggy and you don't know if you're going to stay there or stuck and you cannot move. But I wanted to cross, not in helicopter, but I want to cross in a small boat. And it turned to be a very small boat, very mm-hmm. dangerous, but danger suits me. Mm. So I crossed the Bering Strait all the way around, finding that, I don't know if you are, I mean, you have a knowledge how the Bering Strait is from Alaska towards Siberia, is 80 kilometers, and in the between, there's two islands. During the Cold War, the United States took the small island, and Russia took the big.
Just
am I okay?
I think you're great. I think it's. I think we're gonna introduce the clip. So now that we've been talking about it, so we can see a little bit what's happening. And I think you're doing great. I just don't want to cut you. No. But we will follow up after the clip. Okay. We'll follow up. Yeah, just so that we get to see what you're describing right now. Okay. So tell us a little bit of what we're gonna see. The clip that we're gonna show next.
So there's two islands called the Diomedes, and one is Russian, and the other one is North American. But the Russian, they took all the inhabitants from there to Siberia, and they put a military base in that big island. So you cannot cross because there's an imaginary frontier that even the people from there, they cannot cross, and they cannot move because it's a straight frontier there in between of the two islands. So I was stopped by the line of time, because the time and everything, the day, the time, everything changes from one island to the other one. Mm. So I was stopped there, but like my work was conceptual, I decided, I couldn't go beyond. So when I went back, I started developing my projects and my ideas, and then I work in three video installations. One is called Fluxus, the other one called Frontier, and the other one is the new Bering, the new Man of Bering. But those are like ideas, no? But when I show them in a museum in Mexico City, I like to read all what the people, the comments of the people, you know, for me are the most important thing of an exhibition. So when I start reading, I got two very strong feelings. One was that I make them think. And if my work makes people think, I'm very pleased. And the second one was that they want to know more about the Bering Strait. But because, yes, and I say myself, yes, Lourdes, you are very abstract, and you are working with concepts, but people needs to know what's going on. So I decided to work on a documentary, and then I start like studying the things, and since the first trip, we start recording interviews with the people and landscapes and everything, so that allowed me to build up the documentary. And that's the way that it turned to be this documentary, Bering Strait, Equilibrium and Resistance, because when I was talking with my friend, we said the only way to support this moment on life is with equilibrium and resistance. and that's why the name of the film, and that's it.
Okay, you want to lead us into the clip that we're gonna watch? Introduce the clip. What we're gonna see? The clip that we're gonna show. We're gonna show a clip of Bering Strait. Do you wanna talk a little bit about it?
Yeah. Well, it's it better see it, no?
Okay.
And
let's see.
I mean, no sense that I'm going
it's four
to talk
minutes.
Of something that you are going to watch.
Okay. Well, you started saying something about it. I think you told us how you started with this project. First, it started off as a photography project, and then it evolved into a documentary. Is that the second part, third part? I'd like to know a little bit, what's the difference between, I mean, now when working in film, tell us a little bit about your team, who was with you in this process, you know?
How? Well, I didn't feel a big change because the thing, I mean, my language is image. Mm-hmm. So, I understand the world by my eyes. So I think that, and that's the way I have been working all my time. No, I do the support that I need. I feel what the subject matter that I'm going to be working with asks me, no, so that I respond to that. So for this film, I had a group of young friends that helped me to do all the electronic stuff and whatever. And then I made my team. It had to be a small team because of the budget and because of the place. So I have a cameraman's son that lives here in Los Angeles, to walk blocks from here. He has been working here in Los Angeles. He moved up here 15 years ago. And he's I'm the mother. He's a very good photographer. And I have another son that he's a musician. So I took my two sons and then another friend of them, which I met since he was a little boy, and he was a producer. And I met another young guy that is a very good editor. And so that was my team. And the fifth of us went up to the Bering Strait. And it was great to work that way, no? Because I had to tell them, please, excuse me if I break the line between being a mother or being a director. Mm-hmm. But we were really very, very well, no? And we made up a very good team, and I'm very pleased with the result. And that's something that it helped a lot, if you see the film. All the interviews are really very close. I mean, I got this feel, and that's the way I like to work, that to get in contact with people and to be like confident. I mean, because I know that the camera is very aggressive. So what we did, it was, we arrived, we didn't use the cameras until we get in touch with the people. The first trip helped most of the people we met since the first trip. So we made a very good relationship, and that's the way we should. And I like that because I got the feeling that the people really opened themselves and they collaborate very well. And we spent a very good time because the boys were play with the boys and the girls from the school. They play together and so on. So I think that we really got into the community, you know? And that's the way we worked. And that's the way, I mean, I like to work that way, you know?
Good. Okay, now Juliana, we're going to see a clip of La Donna. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So in this point in the film, she has married her high school sweetheart, Fred Harris, who's an up-and-coming state senator. I don't think he had become a state senator yet. He was working in a law firm. He just finished college, and they were starting a family. And there's a town in Oklahoma called Lawton, and that's where our tribe is based. But it was also a military town and had quite a large African-American population there. And that's mostly the town that they were raised in. And they go back to town, and it's really her first foray into social activism and sort of the impetus to what kind of leads her to her future. So she's young, she's not educated, her husband is, but she's not, and this is sort of her first step.
Okay. Juliana, you have been working in the film industry as a director or producer, but why the need to make La Donna Indian 101? And who was your target audience for this film? And also, as a Comanche yourself, you felt attached to the subject? And also, while making it, did you maybe try to detach yourself? How was that process?
Yeah, well, obviously, access is the best thing you can have as a filmmaker, is to have some sort of close access. And if you don't, you have to work, as you were saying, really hard at forming that relationship to get them to get comfortable with you enough to talk intimately and comfortably. And so I thought, because LaDonna was close to my grandmother was her, she was orphaned, and her grandparents who raised LaDonna were her aunt and uncle, and so they took her in. And so my grandma sort of helped to raise, she was older than her, older than LaDonna, and helped to kind of raise her. So they were close, and then throughout the years, my aunties and uncles and everybody, they all worked together. A lot of my family work in Indian health services and various programs. And so you know, my mom's generation was close with her, so I felt that having that access would give me, or having that relationship would give me an access, you know, that would be, you know, helpful of making a documentary. So that was kind of one of the most obvious. But really, her story is so inspiring. And when you meet her in person, I wish she were here tonight, but she's so, it's hard to explain how charming and magnetic she is and how inspiring she is and how positive she is. And she's always, always positive about things. I mean, yeah, she's human. She has, you know, things that bother her. But she always has this way of turning things around. She looks at things so differently than anybody I've ever known, that it's so inspiring. And so as I got to know, it's like more, It was that much more important for me to have these inspiring stories from her perspective, because all we see in Native American stories when you see documentaries are about the problems that we have. And those problems, you know, alcohol, drug addiction, poverty, dysfunction. The boarding schools are a popular subject, which we do address in the film. For audiences that aren't familiar with our history, the boarding schools were a very, very dark part of our history, one of the darkest, and that wasn't very long ago. And so those stories are always kind of retold. And while those are important for people to understand why things are the way they are today, I get that. But what we never see are positive stories about what Indigenous people and Native people are doing in their communities to, you know, proactively, you know, do in their communities to bring themselves up. And so that was a really important thing for me. And it's maybe not that hard-hitting, sad documentary where you leave and you want to, you know, just go drink a bottle of whiskey or something, you know, but like, it's inspiring. And it gives you hope, and it makes, you know, we need more of those stories.
When you say we, it's as a community, the United States as a people, or you say also as Native American viewers?
I think everyone, not just Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. The audience was made for everyone in this room, whether you're Indigenous, Native American, Mexican, white, European, whatever. It doesn't. It was made for everybody. It's just very. It's very educational, mm-hmm. And it's also inspiring for everyone. Because I think if you look at her worldview and you see and you understand her worldview, that's something every one of us can take away, especially now. And she talks about globalization and how everybody talks about oil and gas, and that's what we're always talking about, money and how, you know, resources, instead of talking about how we're going to live together. And the best example there is like right now what's happening in the Middle East. How are we going to live with these people who are so different from us? And just, you know, kind of just a different approach. And so it's something that everybody can take away.
Mm-hmm. And was it easier or was it more difficult? I mean, you are very close to the subject. She's your relative. And also, that's your community you're presented in, mm-hmm. in film. So how do you balance those roles as the filmmaker and as the member of that community?
I think I had to go in knowing that I'm not going to make everybody happy. And the only person I intend to make happy is LaDonna, that I told her story right. And it was difficult because as an elder, we are taught to behave in a certain way. And there's such a strict protocol when talking and dealing with elders that it's very hard to direct. And I come from a reality TV background. So you're kind of pushy and like, this is what I need, tell me this. I couldn't do that. So I had to take that hat off and treat her how everybody should be treated, really. And because that's my obligation as a Comanche and as a younger person, that's your obligation.
Okay. Lourdes, something that the clip that we saw, I think... Mike is okay. What I saw was the recurring theme was the border, you know, and the border. And how would you say your experience and also from what you were able to see people living in that border, how would you compare that to the U.S.-Mexican border or borders in general?
Well, the 3 points that support my project in general is one, that the borders changed and disappear in a way, you know, because of this electronic stuff open us or close us the world. But the sense of frontier changed. The second one is that immigration, which right now we are in a time where immigration is as... is comparable to prehistoric worlds. No? Now people are moving around all over the world. Even you can be immigrant sitting in your chair. No? And then, and the third point is that what is East and what is West? Because we Americans, American as a continent, not as a country, mm-hmm. You stole the name of a country, America, the whole continent. We had been taught by the Western culture, and that's a European way of dealing with the concept. The America has Western culture, I mean Western in general. For us, is Asia, not Europe. So I have deal with that as well. And I've got a set of still photographs because I want to work with all the media where I compare what is East, what is West in this globalized world. In terms of frontier, the concept of limits still around, no? For instance, that stupid frontier between those two islands. You can see how far the two islands are, and the people cannot move. And it doesn't exist anything. You could see the whales and the birds and the fishes come and go, except for the humans. And that was a place in this world where we know it as a point from one country to the other one. So it was a place in the world where the people go and come. So these are the contradictions that now that was a bridge between two worlds. Now it's broken by a frontier that doesn't exist. So I mean, that's another point. And one of the pieces is a video installation where you see the islands, and where you cross by sensors, you start being shooting, because I mean, you cannot cross that border, even for the people. They suffer that because of they cannot even go to fish animals, because and that's their life, you know? So it's stupid. And well, borders are the same all over. I remember once that I was working with the Papagos, and the Papagos were, I mean, it's the same ethnic group. And they were crossed, and they were broken by a frontier, the same as the Inupiaqs, no? Mm. So it's that sense of frontier is a stupidity. I mean, it couldn't exist anymore.
There's a tribe in Arizona, the Dona Otham tribe, right, in Arizona, that literally that fence is between their relatives, mm-hmm. and that's their old homelands. So their relatives are on this side, and they're on this side, and you can't see them.
And they speak the same language. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same mm-hmm. culture. The yeah. same. You will see if you see the film, the kids and every. I mean, all the my interview views. They talk about we were the same kind of people. Mm-hmm. No, we spoke the same language, and now they haven't seen each other for a long time. No. Mm-hmm. So I think that sense of frontier is
good. Okay. Well, another question that I had for both of you is that you both have been working and filming in Native communities. So how do you see media being helpful to these Native communities, and how is film a good tool for them to preserve their culture?
For me, I think, like I said, the positive message in this story is something that we desperately need in our communities, because like I said, we really only are focusing, and everything that's kind of pushed down our throat is everything bad that's happening in the world and everything bad that's happening in our communities, which, you know, there's plenty of room for that. We need to make more room for the stories that actually give us a reason to want to continue on and make better and do better. And so for me, it's extremely important that this film is seen in all Native communities, and hopefully it'll inspire young people to... There's in the film, I should tell you, the film actually started out as a story about LaDonna's Ambassadors Program, which is a very popular ongoing program that she's had, where she takes a group of emerging indigenous leaders from all over the country, Alaska, Hawaii, you know, all parts of the U.S., and brings them together and, you know, goes through a series of sort of like courses on understanding who you are and the pitfalls of being who you are, how you escape these problems, and how you turn those around to better your community. And it's like a year-long program, and they travel to other indigenous communities in Bolivia or Peru or New Zealand, and these programs are popping up all over the world now, so that they can indigenous people can meet together and find out what's working in their communities versus what's not working, and how they've gone about to do this. You know, New Zealand has an amazing language program. Everybody speaks their language there. All the young people do. And so we're trying to learn from them how you do that and how you, you know, implement. So it's like this great, it's this amazing, it's a program when you think about it. It's probably one of the most important things happening in, you know, positive happening in the indigenous, you know, communities around the world. But so So she started this program. The film, it was originally about that. And I was following a class, her 2010 ambassadors class, and following them as they kind of went on this trajectory. But then, as I was showing cuts to people, everybody, working LaDonna's story into that, everybody really just really wanted more LaDonna. So it ended up becoming a biography on LaDonna. But the end of the film ends on, you know...
Which we're going to see a clip.
Which we'll see shortly, yeah. Kind of brings it all together. And so that program, that training mentorship program, is an incredible tool. And the people that come out of this, which has been going on now for 15 years or more, people coming out of this are doing incredible things in their communities. Educators, lawyers, doctors, just you know, political, working in the political arena, like just doing amazing things. So I'd love to see this film being shown in communities, inspiring those young people to say, so I can do this.
Your film is then a tool of inspiration,
tool.
Education, so mm-hmm. I think that's how...
That's the most important thing for me as a filmmaker, I think, is to help create change in some way. And for me, giving back to my community, which is one of LaDonna's teachings, is reciprocity. It's a traditional value most indigenous cultures have, is returning something back to your community. And to me, that storytelling, if I can use my storytelling skill to convey that, then wonderful. And that'll be my reciprocity, my medicine, as she calls it. What's your medicine? What do you have to offer your community or your family? And so, yeah, that's so storytelling is the tool.
Okay.
Well, for me, I think that this globalization is like reinforcing a sense of localism, no? And because I feel that all over the world, the small communities or the people that lives more close to the earth are like being stronger every time, no? And I hope that they can still save their human values, because otherwise I don't know where we will go. No? Mm-hmm. And that's my hope, that this ethnic group that I went to visit, that I didn't have any idea of what will I find, they are, because it's one of the oldest ethnic groups of the world, but now they live in modernity, in modern times. No, they have computers. The kids have video games and everything, and we can say, "Oh, that's awful," but it's not, because I mean that's the way development is. The thing is now to keep your values, use that for something different, and because we have to use the technological stuff for, to send messages, no, or to work with that, because we cannot stop that. No? And I got them. Well, that's my hope, because these ethnic groups they had. North American schools since the beginning of the 20th century. So their minds are absorbed by the North American culture. But that was their only way of knowing. Now with the internet and with this media, now they are open to the world. So I hope that they have this richness of knowing more things about the world, and use the technological stuff to build up another thing, no? Because it's for sure that those human values that we had lost, they still got them or whatever, and they still have this sense of community that we had lost. So for me, that's my main interest, to see how this, because other work that I've got It's a long, long work as well. I have been working with the patients and the actors, a patient theater. It has the same name as Chavez Teatro Campesino, but it's very different. And it's with the Mayas. And it's so, so touching, that work. I had learned a lot about my country because I can see the development of those small communities in Yucatan and Quintana Roo and Tabasco, where they are getting stronger and stronger and stronger, their culture, because they were like, smashed, you know? But now they are getting their sense of security about their culture, and that is growing up, I think, you know? Mm-hmm. And I felt that this community that always lost their language, that's a pity, but they still have human values, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in the sense of languages and traditions, I think film and media is a very useful tool for Native communities coming from that community of a lot of Native filmmakers here. I think that I see it as you mentioned it, our medicine, right? What we contribute to our communities, and the way that we use media is mm-hmm. as a way to preserve this tradition and share it with people. So mm-hmm. I think it's...
And share ideas and learn from those ideas that you...
Yeah, so I think that definitely I personally, since I live as a filmmaker, I think a film is a very important tool.
Right. And you know, with Native Americans, most indigenous, all indigenous communities probably, storytelling is, the oral tradition is one of the most important aspects of our culture. And because we're not static and because our cultures always evolve and they should evolve, I don't think that we should be expected to live in this romanticized version of history. We're always evolving. Everybody evolves. I think it's okay that we live in this world now, but that we take those old traditions and sort of form them into the new ones. And I think using media is just an offshoot of our oral tradition. This is our new oral tradition.
Yeah. Now, since finishing the films, have you been able to return back to the communities where you filmed it? And then if you did, what was the reaction?
You mean...
Both of you. When you finished the film now, Bering Strait, have you returned back to that village? Have they seen it?
I must go to show the film to them. Okay. But now I'm working on the part two, because I found out that I was recording just half of the Bering Strait, mm. and I need to record the other half. Mm-hmm. So now what I'm going to do is to go from Siberia to Alaska, you know? Because, it's funny, mm-hmm. but it's something you cannot do. Mm. And so I have half, now I need to do the other half, and I'm working on that.
Mm. And then you have a film to screen.
Yeah. My story sort of takes place all over the place because we talk about a lot of different, we visit a lot, several different places, but in terms of our community in Lawton, where LaDonna is from, our tribe is from, they have not seen it yet. We're planning something, hopefully this November, to do something kind of big and special with our tribe.
And LaDonna has seen it?
I'm sorry, LaDonna has seen it, yes. Yes, she's very pleased.
Share us a little bit what, how, where, when.
What's that?
When did she see it?
She's seen several versions.
You were telling us earlier that you were at the Michael Moore's Film Festival?
Yes, Michael Moore's Film Festival in Traverse City, Michigan. We went this summer, and she saw it, and we watched it together in the theater the first time, you know, on a big screen with, you know, high resolution video, and it was really... It was a really great experience, and when she came out for the Q&A, it was standing ovation, and people were just crying, and we were both crying, and it was a really beautiful thing. And our hosts, the Grand Traverse Tribe of Chippewa Indians, hosted us, and they were amazing. And it was just a beautiful, you couldn't ask for a better experience. So we'll take it to the Comanches, and that'll be a really great time. I did screen it in Oklahoma, my hometown in Oklahoma City. Oh, I'm from Norman, but close to Oklahoma City, and we screened that this summer. It was actually on my birthday, and so all my family came out, and And that was really fun and exciting because this is a really kind of family movie.
The first time I screened one of my films, student films, my mom made a little like tostadas, like little tortillas for everybody. Everybody left was clapping. Of course, I don't know if the film was good, but they got fed. And that was very encouraging. Okay, well, now we're going to show our last two clips. And after that, we're going to open it up for us, for you to ask questions. Do you want to say anything about this clip? Anything that I didn't ask that you want to share now?
This clip is the closing scene I was just sort of talking about, an idea of globalization and where we're at and where we're going. That's really it, you'll see.
Okay. Let's watch it. Okay, well, now we're going to open it up for the audience to ask some questions. I still have more questions if you...
That was beautiful. Thank you. I was so moved to hear how, Lourdes, how you were motivated by a dream, and someone else's dream even, and I wondered, Juliana, were there any dreams that came into play that instructed you during the making of your film?
No, but mostly nightmares about how I'm going to raise the money, how I'm going to finish it. Do nightmares count? A lot of those.
I was wondering, that's such a haunting image of that citizen border patrol agent with his hat. Sort of firing into the distance and on this imaginary line. And I wondered if you have some sense of him as a symbol, whether it's a symbol of hope or a symbol of despair.
Well, yes, in a way it is, no? Because it's like... shooting against something that it's built up. Because if you see the film... They say there are people like us. They live there. They live people like us, and it's finished. No, so yeah, in a way, it is.
Yeah, those were incredible. But I have to ask, how do indigenous people and get to have access to be able to create films and actually learn to do it properly, films or, you know, any sort of media, rather than, you know, being, kind of pushed aside on that, you know, get good training on that, on, you know, able to do it, as well as, as getting access to be able to be distributed decently.
We're not there yet. We definitely don't have distribution, any ideal distribution. I mean, I see so many great films, made by non-Native filmmakers that have Native actors or Native storylines that will never get picked up and never seen except at film festivals, which is one of the wonderful things about especially Ambulante. And having us here to see these films that you wouldn't typically see, because we are at a disadvantage. There's no training. A lot of filmmakers that I know are self-taught. I had the privilege of going to college. I also have the privilege of being half white. But I think in indigenous communities on a reservation where you don't have lack of access to anything, especially technology, it's just a struggle. So people really have to be passionate about it. And everybody has a phone now, so I think that's a big way to start with your internet and a telephone to shoot things. And it's cheaper now, so it's to buy cameras. And then I think it's more about mentors. Money is never easy. And that's a huge struggle for everybody. So, good question.
Lourdes, I was wondering about, you said that you felt strong influence from both Eastern and Western influences, and you spoke so eloquently. I'm wondering what Eastern influences stand out as prominent to you.
La influencia del este, que hablaste muy bonito sobre todas las influencias que has tenido en tu trabajo. Entonces, ¿quieres saber qué influencias del este específico, alguna específica influencia
en,
en tu trabajo?
Well, yeah, I have been thinking since a long time ago of what the Mexican culture offers to me. Instead of thinking in Europe or New York, going towards the founts, the meanings of the Mexican cosmovision.
Cosmovision.
No? And I have worked, once I made a video on Prometheus, and instead of going towards the Occidental God, I tried to find out and study the Mexican God that was the portador. How do you say portador?
Carrier.
Huh?
The carrier.
Of the fire.
The carrier.
And so I worked with that idea, and so that's what I have been trying to. Because I'm really fed up with all this Latin American, I don't know if you have it, but Latin Americans, we still keep the colonized mind, no? And we still work that way. And I'm fed up about that, no? So what I'm trying is like to go into our fields, into our sources, no? And that's why it makes me think about what is West and what is East, no? And those are the meanings.
Thank you. I'm wondering, as women of color filmmakers, if you can talk a little bit about who has influenced you to be who you are today.
¿Cuáles han sido sus influencias como mujeres cineastas minoritarias, no sería? ¿Cuáles han sido nuestras influencias? ¿Cuáles han sido las influencias del trabajo? ¿Quién ha influenciado en su trabajo? ¿Qué trabajo?
But you said as women?
As women of color.
Well, I could say that my influence as a human being, not as a woman. That's because I'm not a feminist. I believe in humanity, and for me the influences. I'm open to the world. Also, I couldn't say what has been my influence. What I try to do is to do what I believe in, and that's the way I develop my ideas.
That's a really good question. It's a question I don't think I've ever been asked that, but I feel kind of the same way. I mean, influence is just, I think what drives me just in general are issues. Filmmakers always inspire me. Documentaries inspire me. Filmmakers like Alison Anders was one of my first, I've realized that women can do this too. That was in college when I first figured out who she was and what she was doing. I thought that was cool. And then documentary filmmakers like Errol Morris were an inspiration to me. But anything truth, anything nonfiction is inspiring to me, and people in my family are inspiring. My stories of my family are fascinating, and this is just one small bit of it. Like, my whole family is fascinating, and our history is history inspires me and influences me. So I guess it's a bunch of things.
Thank you. I am Canadian as well as American. And living in Canada, I learned that we have Canadians that own land both in Canada and the United States. So you could have your, and not only that, your house could be, like your kitchen could be in the United States, and your living room could be in Canada, or vice versa. And I don't know how people decide, well, when they have birth, if they're born half and half, I don't know. But if you consider working that as part of the globalization, and that would affect people in various countries, that they could have the same problem. And I just think that would be interesting to add that to both of you.
Hmm. Another question?
Well, I think that globalization has good things and bad things. And for me, one of the good things is that now we are open. My generation, we were more extreme. Now, I love to see the film. Just to see Juliana's clips, I want to see the film tomorrow. And it surprised me. Well, it's not, it's all the time surprise. But how the ethnic groups start melting together, you know? Now, and you can see it in the art. I think that all this mixture of different cultures gives you another product, richest for me, for myself, is richest. If you see, if you hear the music of different countries and meld together, it gives you a good and a new sound. You know? Well, we speak in terms of good stuff. But I think that for me, globalization has that good thing. And for humans, it's the same. No? We are like connecting ourselves easier than we used to do it before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a beautiful way to wrap up our evening. We thank you for coming, and please come and see the movies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.